welcome to the Soleri Report. Today is January 2nd, 2014. It's a new, fruitful year, yes. And this is Catherine Austin Fitz. I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Tonight is our annual wrap-up, and because of the significance of this report and how much material we wanted to synthesize for you in this report, we've built a special website. And you can, if you go to the blog post, you can link to it from the annual wrap-up blog post. It's in the subscriber-only section, so you're going to need to log in. And I would encourage you to go log in and link to it now, because the graphs and charts may help you as you follow along. But feel free to access this and read it in your leisure. We will next week start to publish a transcript from the web material and post it at the subscriber resources and on the blog post as soon as it's ready. And so that will be easy to print out. You can certainly print out the website one now, but the PDF will make it a little bit easier to both print out and share with family and friends. I want to stress, because we use many different charts in this report of different markets and different assets, that nothing should be taken as an investment advice. You see the disclaimer on all of our materials, and it's at the bottom of the website, but I really want you to take this to heart. Even if I think an asset class or investment is attractive, it doesn't mean it's attractive at today's price, or it doesn't mean it's attractive given what's going on. So, and it certainly doesn't mean it's attractive in your unique situation. So please, please take the disclaimer to heart. Our theme tonight for the annual wrap-up is the same that we've chosen for our poster for 2014. You'll see it up at the top of the blog, and of course we'll have it up at the blog all year long. And that theme is breakaway. Now, let me explain breakaway. There are deep and very significant shifts in investment and credit occurring as we speak. And as Sullivan used to say, this is really, really big. The changes that this will make ripple across society. I said in our introduction on the website that this is like the water table and the rivers and streams, all the water in a place changing in volume, changing in direction. When something that deep changes, it changes the fundamental economics of almost everything, and the change ripples throughout the ecosystem. So it changes where you want to work. It changes the skills that are valuable. It changes where you want to build your home. It changes the feel, the energetics around you, and can dramatically impact both personal and business relationships. In that kind of world, there are unique risks and opportunities. So let's step back. We prepared a chart to help you understand, again, what I say when I talk about the financial coup d'etat has come to the close. The period we saw that shifted trillions of capital out of the traditional industrial model, both private companies, communities, households, governments, the financial coup d'etat that started in 1995 with the creation of the WTO has come to a close. What we've seen since the bailouts is an effort by the leadership to clean up the fraudulent securities and essentially pass through the statute of limitations and shred the remaining documents and criminal liabilities. And that process is now drawing to a close. And that means the money that has been shifted is now free to invest in what I call a new model, Global 3.0, which is a much more networked model organized around digital systems. It's part of the transference. We've seen much of it with assets going from governments into private investors and private corporations. Again, to give you the sense of the magnitude of the capital flows, we prepared a chart to go through the history, particularly for those of you who are relatively new subscribers. The process of building the flows through the black budget and the financial coup d'etat are something that the longstanding subscribers of the Soleri Report are very familiar with. But if you're newer, that chart may help put these comments in historical context. And so I'm going to use in this report the model of shifting resources out of what I call global 2.0, which more or less is the world that's fading, into global 3.0, which is the world that's growing. So you might want to link to that chart that you can is on the website to just help you get the historical perspective on this. What is now happening with the capital ready to be reinvested, it's akin to a dam being demolished and the water starting to rush downstream. We can agree or disagree with the decisions that were made to affect the financial coup d'etat and essentially clean and cover up the fraud that helped finance it. The reality is it's happened, and the question for all of us is, what does it mean for us and those we love, and what is it we need to do? What's the action? You've heard a lot of discussion last year and this year on the Solari Report, particularly with John Rappaport and myself, talking about the power of your imagination, how to gather real power in a world that's changing this way, the importance of learning how to invent our world and contribute to inventing the world around us. And those skills are very, very important in the time that we're coming into, because when you break away from a world that's fading, you have to choose. Do you want to choose the vision, the stereotype that others have created for your future and your life? Or do you want instead to invent a world that you want to live in, and again, one that you want to leave to future generations? So the capital is being shifted out of 2.0. It's being reinvested in 3.0. That means things are changing, and that means life is going to get very unpredictable if it hasn't been already. In the special report I did at Halloween on the zombie thing, I described a scene in World War Z where Brad Pitt, who's running from the zombies, hides temporarily with a family that's frozen in fear, hiding in their apartment, hiding from the zombies. And he says to them, he describes that in places or times of distress, such as the one they're in, he says, movement is life. Movement is life. Breakaway is about choosing life. It's about taking the movement you need to shift towards life. You've heard the term breakaway civilization a lot on the Solari Report. In no sense is breakaway about aligning with the breakaway civilization or necessarily following them unless that's what you choose to do. In one sense, the breakaway civilization's movement of money and resources out of global 2.0 is causing or triggering the urgency of the shift. But at the same time, breakaway, our kind of breakaway, is about facing the facts of the fact that global 2.0 is now managing more liabilities than they have assets and is also in the process of losing its fundamental legitimacy in our eyes. But it's also about being attracted into the kind of future that, as I said, we want to invent. John Adams, talking about the American Revolution, once said that the revolution is in the hearts and minds of the people. Breaking away, first and foremost, has to happen in our hearts and in our minds. I likened on the introduction that I wrote for the website that it's a little bit like being on a high-speed bicycle, and it's part of why we chose the bicyclists for our posters. If you've ever done serious touring on a high-speed bike, you start out in the morning, you start down the road, you feel stiff, your body warms up, you pick up the pace, then suddenly you feel a surge of energy, you break out, you find your flow. It's an amazing speed, but the exertion is easy because you're on your way. It's a breakaway. So our annual wrap-up is designed to help you get a good integrated map of where we've been and what may be ahead, at least the trends. It's designed to help you access the archive of Solari reports that can help you to understand the landscape. The uncertainty is unprecedented. No one can tell you what's going to happen. I don't think even the factions vying for power or to try and determine where things go can even tell you where things go. I'm reminded of when I used to work on Wall Street, the chairman of our firm would come into the meeting at the beginning of the year and he'd say, I can tell you what's going to happen. I just can't tell you when. While the uncertainty is unprecedented, a good framework can help you organize the dynamics and variables and help you see the bobs and weaves and help you navigate as events unfold. I sent the poster to my good friend and ally, Thomas Hupp, and he emailed me back and he said, Happy New Year. He said, I got the image of the bikers. Is that all the good guys blazing through the tapeworm? I replied, indeed, indeed. So as we break away, let's break away from the tapeworm. Okay. Let's look at the big trends and both for 2013 and 2014. Number one, the slow burns wins again. The slow burn is my scenario for a steady debasement of liabilities in a process that is ever more centralized and managed, where for the broad middle class in the developed worlds, the household incomes is steadily drops and expenses rise. And it's a process of squeeze. Some people call it financial repression. I've said for many, many years, as many people in the financial media on the internet have predicted collapse, I've said, no, it's not going to collapse. It's slow burn. It's going to slow burn. Last year, I said it was a 75% chance that it would slow burn. The reason it wasn't higher was we still entered 2013 with significant fraudulent securities outstanding. That had financed the financial coup d'etat. That made the management of the interest rate swaps that had been used to keep interest rates down even more problematic, and so there was clearly risk in the system. Not only did the slow burn continue, but it displayed unprecedented strength as the reinvestment in Global 3.0 kicked in. I had underestimated the speed and power of that reinvestment. We'll be talking about it tonight. But the leadership, as they enjoyed the reduction of personal and corporate liabilities that has happened as a result of the bailouts and the Fed's quantitative easing, and of course, as the statute of limitations have reached on trillions of dollars, they're beginning to feel their oats. So moving forward, I think the chances of the slow burn continuing throughout 2014 are good. I would now give it 80%. Because of what's happening with interest rates in the bond markets, which we'll be discussing tonight, I still think that there is significant risk in the financial system, and it comes down to whether or not the leadership can hold together and manage that. It's not going to be easy, and it's going to create pain throughout the economy in a variety of ways. So the slow burns wins. Second very important trend is the competition for the slow burn train tracks heats up. One of the reasons that I have been adamant over the last 10 to 15 years that we're going to slow burn our way through is because I've had a very personal and intimate education in the different systems that are used to control the economy and really people throughout the culture. It's not just the economy, it's really are, you know, the political control of places and the political control of different businesses and industries and sectors and activities throughout the civic area in our cultural life. Traditionally, military and intelligence power and enforcement has been at the core of control. So the navies, the nations that had navies and controlled the sea lanes and now the satellite lanes have traditionally controlled and maintained the global reserve currency. But as our society has evolved, we have shifted more and more warfare from overt warfare to covert warfare. And that covert warfare has increasingly played out through the financial system, but always backed up by military power and force. So the, you know, sort of financial and economic warfare have been the bloodless way to engage in warfare. And of course, one of the frustrations for many nations and people around the world is it's very difficult to use a financial system that you're using to invest and transact when other people are using it to play very brutal games of economic warfare. Inside of all of this, the thing that's made a lot of what's happening possible is the digital systems that have supported a much more high-powered and invasive communication system, and giving way to much more treacherous financial systems, is a certain number of players have the ability to access incredible intelligence about financial transactions. And in part, the role of satellites in that communication system is part of what's shifting the competition into space that we'll be talking about tonight. For many years, I've referred to these invisible digital systems as the data beast, and you can read my article, The Data Beast. It's up on our website, and I'll link to it from the annual wrap-up web presentation tonight. What has been very interesting to me, I've struggled to explain to our subscribers the power of the digital systems to literally collect and synthesize what millions, if not billions, of people are writing about, talking about, whether phone and email and fax, and aggregating and using artificial intelligence to translate that data into high-speed actionable items that include influencing opinion, transacting on inside information, marketing to and exploiting households. It's very hard for many people to fathom that such a matrix exists, and it's why Andrew Vox, one of my favorite mystery writers, once referred to the internet as the ultimate op. Well, enter Edward Snowden in 2013, and put aside the reasonable and legitimate questions to ask about really who is Edward Snowden and who's financing and backing him. Put that aside, he has given the American people and the global population an extraordinary education with the help of Glenn Greenwald in the kinds of surveillance and economic warfare that we are dealing with in this world. And what's interesting is that is happening just as the internet and the mobile payment system is beginning to blossom into a global network. And so just at the time that the financial transactions and retail transactions are moving online, we see a fight for the heart of these transaction and control mechanisms. I've talked before this year about the danger of the balkanization of the internet as a result of these revelations, because what we're now seeing as more than a trillion people get on the mobile systems and start to transact and build payment systems leading to a digital currency, the power of that network and control of that network gets ever more important. And so literally we're watching the BRIC nations say, oh, we need to create our own cable. We need to create our own satellite systems. We need new forms of encryption. Otherwise, we're going to lose at the great game of global economic warfare. And this battle for the internet and internet freedom, which includes a battle about net neutrality, is coming to a head. We saw it start to come to a head in what I call the week from hell on April 15th. If you remember, it was the Boston Marathon bombing. It was the precipitous drop in precious metals. It was the lockdown of the Boston universities only a few months after the very suspicious death of Aaron Swartz. And at that same time, the House just happens to pass CISPA. Luckily, the Senate refused to comply, and CISPA remains dead on arrival for now. But interestingly, what followed that push to get CISPA passed was suddenly the Snowden revelations. And you see tremendous pushback with people saying, no, you cannot have total central control of these train tracks because they are at the heart of global control and the management of the slow burn. This is happening not just because of the mobile devices, but we're seeing the network, the internet, extended to a networks of things, cars, houses, highways. I put a wonderful chart from Business Insider up about the number of connects that we're seeing. They point out we only have less than 2 billion people networked, rising quickly though, but they point out it's most of the money is already networked and online. Now, of course, that's most of the existing money once you get 7 billion people connecting through mobile phones with smartphones and payment systems. The monetized population is going to expand. Another faction involved in this is the IT and telecom players. I've said in our blog post that the NSA, cutting the NSA's power, in fact, we may end up with a situation that's worse than the one we have, because the NSA and the government have financed and built out these surveillance and invasive technologies and train tracks. If the NSA withdraws, it will leave the private players with more and more control, both on the overt side and the covert side. Many of them will continue to be financed by the government. And as we squeeze out governmental oversight, the power of the Congress to oversee or different laws to apply diminishes. The private players have no reporting requirements to Congress or the American people, or limited. And turning the network, if you will, over them to them could bring a whole new round of control that is even more frightening than what we've seen happen to date. So the battle over the train tracks of slow burn are clearly escalating, and that's going to continue as we see more and more of the global population come online, and more development of the payment and wallet systems that will allow people to transact by mobile. And that, of course, is leading to the development of the global currency. Our third section, and very important area to understanding what's been going on in 2013 and will happen in 2014, is we call the oil card roars towards a resilient model. The model that is currently being adapted, and I think it's a transition model for energy globally, is a very resilient model. Basically, the leadership is saying we want some everything. We don't want to bet the ranch on anything. We want a little bit of everything, and we want to see how everything evolves and see what emerges as the most effective in different kinds of situation. But clearly the word is resiliency. They don't want to bet the ranch on any one aspect of the energy business. Jim Norman, veteran reporter, joined us on the Solari Report in December again. Jim's been on the Solari Report more than just about anybody. His framework for the management of oil and gas prices for geopolitical strategic goals, which he described in his book, The Oil Card, Global Economic Warfare in the 21st Century, I think goes a long way to explaining what's really happening in the global energy markets. 2013 was a very important year. The dollar functions as a reserve currency on an implied petro-oil standard. Energy is directly and indirectly 40 to 50% of the cost of manufacturing North America, according to Jim. What that means is we've built a manufacturing capability that can literally allow most of the machines and automation to do the work, making energy a much more important component of cost than labor. So now, since 2005, America has moved very aggressively to develop domestic oil and gas reserves. Part of that is the development of new and controversial fracking technology, and the other is the development of the North Dakota formations. Both of these combined has contributed to booming economics in the impacted areas, drive through West Texas or North Dakota, and you will see a booming economy. On a net basis, the United States is now an energy exporter. We continue to import a lot, we continue to export a lot, but on a net basis, we're an energy export. What that means is we are continuing to benefit from maintaining a high global oil price, one significantly above cost, if Jim is right, and I think he is, and that allows us to command the energy industry to assert global dominance, particularly over China. But while we do it, we enjoy a significantly lower domestic gas price domestically than natural gas in Europe and Asia. And that is an enormous competitive advantage and one of the reasons I think we're beginning to see tremendous manufacturing energy in the United States. The growth of the domestic reserves is impacting foreign policy. It changes how we think about what we want to do in the Middle East or in Eurasia. And it gives us the ability to do much more of the proprietary and sensitive functions or new high-tech applications here at home without a tremendous cost disadvantage. One of the most painful things to watch in the energy area was Japan's struggle with its nuclear policy. On one hand, their population is reeling from the devastation caused by events in Fukushima and bringing up back online their nuclear network would have very significant political repercussions. On the other hand, the cost of keeping the Japanese manufacturing juggernaut going with expensive fossil fuel that needs to be imported into an island represents an enormous tax. And that cost this year was very much papered over by very aggressive monetary policies in Japan that caused their equity markets to rise by more than 20%, the Nikkei rising by more than 50%. Continuing concerns about Fukushima and its impact on the oceans and global radiation levels has not deterred continuing breakthroughs in new and considered to be much more economic and safe nuclear energy technology. I put a link to an MIT technology review for energy that describes some of that. Fracking in the United States has been such a boon and support to the dollar that fracking is now going to go global. Expect lots of controversy coming out of Europe in 2014 as the sparks fly over fracking in Europe. We saw renewable energies continue to grow. Dramatic growth is ahead, particularly as the cost of solar continues to drop. As those drops continue, it becomes more and more economic vis-a-vis coal. Coal continues to do strong globally, weak in the United States. But as solar encroaches, it's gonna impact coal. Renewable energy shows no signs of replacing fossil fuels anytime soon. The official story is it's going to take many decades of dependency on fossil fuel for renewable to catch up and provide meaningful energy supplies. The growth of renewables, though, is having and low-cost gas is really hitting many utilities hard who are struggling with the high cost base. I think one of the reasons you're seeing a pressure to install smart meters globally is that before new energy technologies, whether renewable or breakthrough energy, bring significant cost declines, you want to have the billing power in place so you can extract all of the savings for the producers as opposed to the consumers. But we'll see what the truth says according to what happens, what lies ahead. So the challenges the utilities are going to face are going to be very, very significant. They're a perfect example of sort of global 2.0 model entities that are struggling to make to adapt to the creative destruction of what's happening by 3.0 energy and renewable investment. I attended the Breakthrough Energy Conference this year in Boulder, and we had one of the speakers and sponsor on the Solari report. We continue to hear of many breakthrough energy technologies getting significant corporate investment and interest. Whether or not those are ever brought out to the consumer, we will just have to wait and see. But they're there, and and it will be very interesting to see how and they come forth. I suspect a lot of it will have to do with the evolution of the global digital currency, because the fossil fuel model and the currency are very much tied one to the other. There's no way the Anglo-American Alliance is going to give up the control of the currency just to bring in new energy technology. So watch the evolution of energy as we watch the evolution of the currency. We saw a very aggressive effort starting in the fourth quarter to start to promote investment in renewables, with several university campaigns getting underway to encourage their endowments to stop investing in fossil fuel. Question I have is, are we watching a pump and dump of the so-called clean stocks? Across the board, they're up about, you know, a basket of clean tech stocks is up about 100% for the year. The greatest high flyers were, believe it or not, all things Elon Musk, who continued to capture applause as America's favorite high-tech entrepreneur. The stocks of Tesla Motors and Solaris City were both high flyers, and it shows you the kind of interest in those areas. I calculated at the end of the year that Ford was trading at a market valuation of $30,000 per car produced. Tesla Motors was trading at a per car valuation of $750,000 per car. Hard to believe that that difference makes economic sense, but we will see what we shall see. Okay, investment shifts from global 2.0 to 3.0. As I said, we've seen $40 trillion plus shifted during the financial coup d'etat, more shifting into the black budget. And now my bet is the North American manufacturing renaissance is on. Question is why? We explored with Dr. Joseph Farrell on several occasions over the last 2 years what this is all about. There are many possibilities. It could be the political pushback from the BRIC nations has been too unpleasant. Nobody wants to get dependent on them if relations are going to be dicey. It could be because we're privatizing some of the space program and parts of the defense industry, as well as the private space program, want to stay within its own jurisdiction to keep proprietary technology away from global competitors. It could be because outsourcing to different countries is tricky. It's not everything it's cooked up to be. It could also be with weirder weather or even weather warfare, we don't want long supply lines. We want to shorten up those supply lines. And of course, maybe new fabrication technology and robotics can do all the things that they're, you know, that some people promise they could do. Whatever the reason, America has many attractive features. North America has food, it has water, it has low-cost energy. While the workforce costs are not competitive with many in the emerging markets, the spread between our labor force and the global labor force has narrowed significantly in the last two decades as a result of globalization. And, of course, the power and influence of the unions has been cut dramatically, particularly in many places. It would not surprise me to see that the pullback we're watching really represents a pullback of the Anglo-American Alliance into the English-speaking nations, Canada, U.S., U.K., New Zealand, Australia, as the dance between Russia, China, and U.S. gets increasingly tense. Part of this is, as I've mentioned before in the Solari report, one of the hidden opportunities in the budget, in the federal budget, is the cost-plus model and reengineering the cost-plus model. A lot of government contracting, particularly military contracting, is done on a cost-plus model, which has driven costs up enormously compared to what they could be if a more flexible model was permitted. It is possible, in theory, on many functions to reengineer the manufacturing or production process so that costs can come down dramatically and profits come up, and so everybody wins. The companies make more money, and the government pays less for the same service. It's noted when SpaceX did the first private rendezvous with the International Space Station for NASA in 2012, their costs were significantly below what NASA estimated it would have cost if they'd done it through government procedures and cost-plus contracting. So with pressure from the fiscal cliff, one possibility in this North America process is the possibility of manufacturing or reengineering manufacturing for the portions related to government sort of cost plus work. It wouldn't surprise me if one of the reasons behind the financial coup d'etat was the desire to create endowments to undergird the finances of the breakaway civilization and do it in a way that will allow a large portion of the military-industrial complex to operate in a much more flexible, privatized model. You go much faster, everybody makes more money, government, taxpayers, whomever pays less. It's very interesting when you look at a chart of the largest government contractor and the largest defense contractor for the year. Despite all the cutbacks, they're having an absolutely gangbuster year. The S&P up almost 30% for the year, their stock up over 60%. Now, defense contractors are talking more and more about foreign sales. It's hard for me to imagine that foreign sales can explain that. I think there's reengineering going on, and I think there's a bit of private space programs going on. I point out in our presentation that the administration has the ability to supply waivers to U.S. corporations to not comply with financial statements and other disclosure required by SEC-related laws and regulations under the pretext of national security. So whenever I look at the corporate profits or financial statements of people who might fit in that category, I look at them with a certain amount of skepticism. We're watching the application of new technologies across the board globally. That's a big piece of shifting from sort of global 2.0 to 3.0. We've done several presentations on the Solari Report to help you understand those. One is a wonderful presentation we did in October by an engineer and an innovation expert on the 3D printing. And really to help you understand, because it's far greater than 3D printing. We described it as mapping out the 3D printing ecosystem. It's really about changing bits to atoms and atoms to bits at much higher speed and lower cost. Then we just posted one during December on industrial robotics. Expect robotics to have a much more visible and profound impact in 2014 and 2015. One part of that is going to be drones. Probably many of you have seen the video shown by Jeff Bezos on what Amazon is planning to do to try and achieve same-day delivery from an online store, including fresh groceries, using drones in American airspace. The FAA is expected to publish a draft rule regulating the use of drones under 55 pounds. We've linked to it in our web presentation. You may want to take a look. The amount of change that such a thing could bring is extraordinary. A lot of the applications, the early applications, are people like farmers or real estate brokers who need very inexpensive aerial views. But drones are clearly coming, and there's something I feel extremely squeamish about. But at the same time, I think there are going to be very many applications of drones that, because of cost saving, that the consumer is going to embrace. And so you look at what's happening, and one of the questions I have is, given what Amazon is doing with same-day delivery and what the local farmer can do to produce and deliver as well, it's worth contemplating the challenges ahead for Walmart and their long supply chains. It's important to understand in this area that you have many companies that you and I associate with leadership in the global 2.0 industrial model who are really leading the change in terms of application of things like robotics to agriculture or I often refer to what Corning is doing to integrate digital technology into glass that can be used in your car as your home. It's quite extraordinary, but expect more and more for the, you know, for the valuations and credit ratings in the markets, in the financial markets, to reflect whether companies are shifting into 3.0 or not. You can't just assume because somebody was a leadership in a leader in 2.0 that they're not shifting into 3.0. Many are leading, but you see deep divisions in the markets as we watch the ones who are making the 3.0 transition shift and the others not shift at all. Remarkable impact in terms of the variation in price earnings ratio. Part of these changes are not really new technology. When you look at the 3D printing situation, what you see is that a lot of this technology has been around. So CAD software has been around for 20 years, but what's happening is it's becoming very high quality and very affordable at a high quality level. And what that means is that many more people, you know, high school kids can now learn and use excellent CAD software. So the technology may not be new, but it's just reaching a point where it's economic. And that means the integration to application is reaching a tipping point and the learning speeds are kicking up. So the combination is very, very powerful. Another area is private space investment. Dr. Farrell and I have talked about this both in the Breakaway Civilization Part 2 that we did in the summer and then recently Covert Wars and the Mysterious Strength of the U.S. Dollar. I think that looking at what's happening in space is very important. The administration, Obama administration, announced on April 15, 2010, that they were going to encourage private investment in space and much more privatization of the U.S. space program. Big questions about what that means to the future of space, future of the human race. What does it mean to the investment outlook? As I said, SpaceX's successful rendezvous with the International Space Station, I think, was a pretty important moment because it proved the private sector could engage in significant space operations at a significant reduction of the cost. So entrepreneurs are suddenly showing up and leapfrogging over the cost-plus world in space. We've also seen a series of Silicon Valley billionaires, along with Ross Perot Jr. and Richard Branson, announced their investment in various space companies, including Planetary Resources, which in 2012 announced that they were going to institute a plan to mine near-Earth asteroids. Planetary Resources is financed by a group of the Google guys, including Google CEO Eric Schmidt. Is this as far out as it might sound? If you look down the road at what Silicon Valley is doing, there are real issues about what metals they need to keep producing the kind of tools and gadgets that they do for their consumers. So it doesn't surprise me that thinking strategically that these folks would be interested in this. You see, Google has now, over the last year, gone out and acquired over 7 robotics companies. Very chilling to think about, given who and what Google is. I said in our write-up for the web presentation that when I was on Wall Street, our partners, big partners in Wall Street firms who cashed out on big money would go out and buy racehorses or racehorse stables or large art collections. Now it seems they start companies that take celebrities to space and use advanced robotics to do space mining. And I think it's really worth contemplating the meaning of that change. We've seen over 2013 an explosion in the popular media, TV, in fashion, a tremendous amount designed to interest the general population, particularly young people in space. One of the examples I give is Chanel's new watch, which is called the J12 Moon Phase Watch. And one of the indications of interest was a group trying to organize a one-way expedition to Mars. Got 200,000 people expressing interest in learning more about how they could sign up for a one-way trip to Mars. I would point out that's approximately double the number of people who signed up for Obamacare in the first month. So we had more people looking to get off the planet to sign up for Obamacare in the initial phase. To give you a sense of what's going on, I think, as I said, part of the interest in space is the incredible importance of the satellite system to the global communication grid. And as more and more of the payment mechanisms move onto that grid and to the mobile networks, those satellite systems grow in importance, which means everybody wants to have their own satellite system. We see China building out its year-old navigation system and offering at low cost or free for everybody else to come use it. It intends to grow that system out to a global one. It's only Asia-Pacific now. But it's an indication that we can expect space investment to continue to grow in 2014 and for some time to come, as it does beware the agenda of space programs replacing the centralized agenda of warfare programs. I put up on the blog the old link to the study from Iron Mountain, where a group of supposed think tank experts get together and say, well, we can't keep the warfare programs taxing the populations forever. Maybe we should use space, because certainly that does capture our imagination, I think, in a way that, the continued military expeditions globally will not. But how much of it is serious and how much of it is simply entertaining, I think it's very serious. And my guess is that part of what's going on in the economy in the United States is the reinvestment in manufacturing in North America to support a much more significant private effort in space. Workarounds are everywhere is the next section within this shift of money. What we're watching as more and more money moves into the 3.0 model is technology and private providers finding workarounds around the old 2.0 industrial model. We're seeing it in healthcare, which is one of the great areas where if you brought the percentage and cost of labor down to the similar kinds of percentage that you have in manufacturing and provided much more in the way of automation and technology, you could get very dramatic cost savings. If the private industry does that, that's very big value creation on their stocks. I quoted Bill Frist, former Senator Bill Frist's healthcare industry outlook, where he says, he gave an example. Traditional technology in healthcare drives up the cost just about across the board. Doing heart and lung transplants or using artificial hearts or stents, all that drives costs up. Technology today is driving the costs down. My iPhone can do a full ECG, not just a pulse rate. That's instead of a $200 ambulance ride to the hospital, a $200 admission fee, a $150 charge for the ECG, and a $200 overread. Now I can do it for free in 30 seconds right here on my phone. A fundamental goal of Obamacare is to incentivize technology companies and private healthcare providers to radically re-engineer labor costs in healthcare. In part, controls placed on hospitals and doctors may be designed to manage their objections to their economic opportunities and income being significantly reduced over time. If you're in the healthcare industry, you want to understand this kind of technological tsunami that's coming and how it will impact you. The digital heartland, another category within this reinvestment in 3.0. For many years, we've seen advanced technology as something that was happening at MIT or at Silicon Valley. Now it's shifting into the heartland. We're talking about integrating advanced technologies and reinvigorating some of the most basic aspects of our infrastructure. I used as an example the railroads. We've seen significant investment rolling into the railroads over the last 10 years. Railroads were always considered to be a pretty sleepy, boring area of the investment world. But if you're going to build very strong oil and gas self-sufficiency and exports, particularly ahead of where you have pipeline capacity, and you want to build a very resilient, distributed high-tech manufacturing base, where you dramatically increase production with lowering costs, you're going to need a low-cost transportation system that can perform on a highly reliable basis, even in extreme or volatile weather conditions. If you drive around the country as much as I do, what you see is the blizzard sidelines the trucks, but those trains just keep flying. So that's railroads. And it's a perfect example where something that was pretty sleepy is getting a lot of attention, a lot of investment, because you need a transportation system that can match and serve your manufacturing system. You also see incredible examples of digital technology and fabrication technology moved into other forms of the infrastructure. One that I put up on the blog this year of a proposal to use jumbo 3D printers to print out houses in a day, or plans for houses that you can build for yourself in a reasonable period of time and cost. One of the most intense competitions is on making autonomous cars. I pointed out that Nissan and Mercedes-Benz have now pledged to produce self-driving cars by 2020. Mercedes is touting their already available very smart driving system. BMW just produced an all-electric car that weighs 600 pounds less than the Nissan Leaf, thanks to carbon fiber. You know, that's a tiny touch of what is coming from the car companies. One of the challenges the car companies have is a lot of the millennials are completely disgusted with the car industry and the costs, and they're balking at buying and committing to becoming car owners. And so watch the auto industry trip over themselves to try and make themselves acceptable and attractive to the millennial generation. Anyway, in closing, for many years, software has been the place to be, but with a digital heartland gearing up, hardware is in the process of getting a lot more intelligent and a lot more of interest to investors. Well, as 3.0 gears up, then what happens is global 2.0 downshifts. The world that is losing assets and losing resources to 3.0 is now going to have to re-engineer to a lower overhead base, or to just simply some organizations and enterprises shift out of existence. We see many different entities in the 2.0 world now in the position of managing very significant retirement liabilities created in the post-World War II industrial phase, who no longer have the assets. Those assets have been moved out to 3.0. They've been moved out through the black budget. They've been moved out through the financial coup d'etat. I often have commentators who say, oh, we're bankrupt, we're all going to collapse. The reality is global 2.0 is going through a staged or managed implosion. So in that sense, yes, we are collapsing and we are feeling a collapse. The reality is one of the reasons the economy is not going to collapse is assets have been shifted out to invest in infrastructure and space programs as opposed to pay for nursing homes and retirements as promised. That's not a pretty picture. I don't like that picture. I was opposed to doing it the way it was done. However, as I said, it has been done, and we need to understand that that money hasn't gone away. It's been shifted and reinvested elsewhere, and it's still working around the economy. So the 2.0 governments may be, they may look bankrupt if you look at their balance sheet, but there are other organizations who have those assets, and they are rocking and rolling. But we're seeing 2.0 organizations struggle, and there are literally thousands of examples, but to give a few that I used, utilities will struggle to maintain profit margins as renewable energy options proliferate. The French government is looking to tax YouTube, if you can believe that, to finance their movie industry. Hollywood will continue to push for internet controls as their market share is threatened. The U.S. government is going to continue to levy new taxes and fines to offset The resources that have been transferred out through the black budget or to please corporate lobbyists. One of the most important strategic questions that all of us in the developed world can ask and answer is, how do we manage our complex personal entanglement with these institutions? How do we break away if that's what it makes sense to do? If you look at the law in America, our assets are often collateral for outstanding liabilities. So, for example, general obligation municipal bonds have a call on the ad valorem taxing power of the municipality, which means ultimately the equity value of our homes are on the hook to pay those bonds. That means citizens absolutely have a responsibility through the courts to the creditors, and the creditors have the power on paper to demand that taxes can be raised to satisfy obligations. So if you look also at the assets on many of our balance sheets, those reflect those liabilities on the larger institutions. So my asset of Social Security is a liability on the federal government's trust fund balance sheet. We have millions of retirees counting on healthcare, pensions, Social Security, for which the larger institutions do not necessarily have the full funding we see in Detroit. Pension beneficiaries waking up to realize that they may be losing healthcare, they may be losing pensions. Part of breaking away means doing what we can to receive what is owed to us without losing time or experiencing emotional drain when the obligations to us are abrogated or are debased as they are being now. But it also means organizing our economic lives to take advantage of the opportunities in the 3.0 model without being fooled about the fact that a lot of the investment flowing into 3.0 represents resources shifted illegally away from many of us. So many of us are going to wake up and find ourselves working to earn or track back our own money, or watch kids or kids in our family financed, with the money stolen from us, while the kids point out to us that the fact that they can raise this capital and build a business is proof that the system really works. There can be some very irritating moments. One of the big gorillas in the room in the story of global 2.0 downshifting is the bond market. The bond market has been the source for sovereign governments and central banks of very significant funding, along with big corporations, large corporations. And it has financed extraordinary expenditures by developed world governments. And those expenditures have fueled corporate profits and services. They've channeled significant resources into the black budget, and they've created very significant employment. Now, if the long-term bull market in bonds is going to come to a close, which I believe it is, and certainly started to in 2012, that brings up very profound questions for how sovereign governments, central banks, and corporations are going to adjust to a world where cheap fixed income money is not necessarily available, and is particularly not available to the government to finance lots of government contracts and purchases. One of the things that has engineered the long bull market in bonds is falling interest rates. And I think falling interest rates are a function of many different things, but one of them is our ability to build and use the derivative market and the interest swap derivatives to bring interest rates down and to manage them. We have never lived in a period when we were managing rising interest rates with a large book of outstanding interest rate derivatives. This is going to be a new thing and an unprecedented event for us. We saw interest rates begin to rise in 2013. In fact, if you started the year with a 30-year bond, a 30-year treasury bond mutual fund, you're down 10 to 15% for the year, which means treasury bonds are not necessarily the safe haven that they used to be. Another institution, or a very interesting example of reengineering as the 2.0 model downshifts. A real high-speed downshift was the very dramatic story of what happened to the Vatican. The Vatican is a very large, very powerful institution trying to shift out of 2.0 and adapt to a 3.0 world. The Vatican and their institutions, their endowments and networks, all within their affiliated umbrella, I would say, are the most powerful financial and investment network in the world. But if you look at their intelligence networks, they have been bested by the juggernaut of the NSA, telecoms, and the online social media and search engines. So as a result, we see them rocked by the financial drain of the pedophilia scandals, which I would really call a control file system scandal, and the alienation of millions of their former members in the developed world who are no longer paying tithes, not wanting to see their money go down the drain in settlements. Their growth opportunity right now is in the emerging market, and that requires a change in leadership and a change in numerous policies. So we see one pope go out and a new pope come in from Latin America who's proceeding to do things with transparency, bringing in outside auditors for the Vatican Bank, which in my world is completely unthinkable, and says to me, we're talking about very dramatic change on the part of one of the most, if not the most powerful institution on the planet. I did a special Solari report with Dr. Joseph Farrell and published several commentaries about events at the Vatican. The Vatican does not have taxing power, which is one of the reasons that it is shifting towards 3.0 much faster than the U.S. government and a lot of sovereign governments. Unfortunately, taxing power results in going slower, but it's a good example of what's going to be happening to a lot of these enormous and huge organizations with big overheads. Another thing that happened as part of the 2.0 downshift is the targeting of the tax havens. As significant funds have moved out of the developed nations and into the tax havens, the sovereign governments have experienced a steady decline in taxes, including corporate taxes. We've seen for the last few years the U.S. Department of Justice lead a campaign against the Swiss banks, ultimately leading to a Swiss capitulation this year in 2013. One of the most painful part of that, one of the worst stories of the year, was the targeting and destruction of the Veglen Bank, the oldest operating private bank in Switzerland. As the Department of Justice in the United States brought Switzerland under its wing, requiring many Swiss money managers to either register with the SEC or send American investment capital back, it put G7 in the position of now announcing a policy of targeting the tax havens. We can think of the debacle in Cyprus as a very early prototype of harvesting the funds in tax havens. The Cyprus Central Bank was ordered to sell its gold. I don't think that was unrelated to the ability of the system to drive down the gold price in April. After G7 announced that they were targeting the havens, what a surprise. We have an immediately convenient scandal at the IRS, removing the leadership and making way for the new head of the IRS, who's in at the end of the year, who is the perfect person to lead a major roundup and hit on the tax havens, working with the Department of Justice and Treasury. So I expect to see move on that next year. If the tax havens are forced, as they did in Cyprus, to sell their gold, I think it could be remarkable the extent to which the central bank should be able to maintain gold prices in a reasonably low trading range in 2014. Obamacare was one of the ugliest downshifts, and it had to happen in the sense that if you look at the growth of Medicare and health care liabilities in the federal government, at the current trajectory, I think we pass the entire GNP within some reasonable period of time, perhaps a decade. So clearly the system was financially out of control and made no sense. U.S. healthcare costs are double, you know, any other developed country or more. And part of that is the inability to reconcile various political constituencies to economic reality. There was a group of House Republicans who did their best to warn the American people about Obamacare got slaughtered at the polls in the process of trying. That left Obamacare to proceed. What's very interesting is it turned out after about 6 weeks of Obamacare, many people who were very negative on the House Republicans' efforts suddenly saw the light and understood what they were talking about. Millions of Americans discovered that they could not, in fact, keep their existing policies. There have been reports of as many as 4 million people losing their policy. There are many people who the private insurance industry clearly took the opportunity to shed baby boomers from their insurance book as those people go from having relatively low per year costs to finally starting to use the insurance that they've been paying for 30 years. It also gave the insurance industry the opportunity to radically re-engineer deductibles and how liabilities are shared. Anyway, many of the people looking for insurance got quite a rude awakening. And you literally hear, and I know of people considering getting a divorce simply to reduce their household income so that they can proceed to afford health care insurance. The process is going to trigger serious questions, and it's also going to trigger serious interest on the part of the technology firms and some of the private health care providers in finding the jump the curve solutions. I talked about the workarounds earlier and the quote from Bill Frist. There are many hidden agendas behind Obamacare, as I pointed out many times in the past, and that includes control. It's not just about reengineering costs. Launching Obamacare in the fourth quarter of 2013 is mighty suspicious to me. It destined the retail industry to have a dreadful Christmas. I can't imagine why you would want to do that to the retail at the end of the year. Why not wait to the first quarter? I'm sure there's a logical explanation. Essentially, the American middle class has been squeezed far more by a decade of slow burn, and you have millions of families that have at most $100 to $1,000 a month in discretionary income. Essentially, Obamacare simply grabbed all of it. It was the tail. It was the amount left over after the slow burn has squeezed everything out. And there is a significant number of businesses whose entire business depends on getting a portion of that $100 to $1,000 a month in discretionary income. I give the example on the website of the casinos in Atlantic City and Las Vegas. They've struggled to maintain their earnings over the last couple of years, and part of it is by offering discount packages right into that audience. Well, Obamacare, can't imagine what's going to happen to them over the next year. Where is the discretionary income going to come to provide real business to many of the businesses that serve that that cohort? It's one of the reasons that if you look at the stock market this year, we see consumer discretionary as the best performing sector in the market, with consumer staples way behind. What that means is rich people have money to spend on luxury goods. The middle class instead are being squeezed. So healthcare was quite a shock. Expect medical tourism to rise in 2014 and going forward, and expect more and more Americans to live abroad in jurisdictions that provide excellent healthcare for as low as 20% of U.S. costs. U.S. pension funds are 2.0 institutions. Many of them can make the transition to 3.0 no problem. They tend to operate pretty lean and keep an eye on what's going on economically for obvious reasons. But there is a huge battle right now over control and influence in the remaining pension fund capital. Real targeting of a campaign against state and local pension funds that very much exaggerates their funding shortfalls and management failures. By and large, the states have pretty good pension funding and are in a pretty strong position. If they're weak, it's because of the healthcare retirement obligations, not the pension funds. My guess is on a lot of these campaigns, the goal is to give Washington and Wall Street more power and control, which is very much the opposite of what we need. So if you see big media picking on your state or local pension fund, just be discerning. There may be a game of economic warfare going on. The trade agreements got stuck in the mud. That's good news. The Doha round of GATT has ground to a halt. Indian farmer suicides and the sort of the global consciousness regarding the fundamental insanity of the GMO model seems to have gotten the Doha round from flying through. We've seen the negotiations of the Trans-Pacific Partnership continue. There have been several invaluable leaks. We've covered them on the blog. No final deal has been achieved. Finally, Codex is stuck in the mud. Thank heavens. But expect those efforts to continue to go. It wouldn't surprise me if the pullback in North America to North America by the Anglo-American Alliance is because they're having difficulty implementing their will, particularly with respect to the global seed and food supply. And they need to control the food supply if they're really going to move to the new currency, or I think that was the plan. The more those agreements get stuck in the mud, the more the plans to do that, to move to sort of a much more global world government system, are delayed. Fundamentals matter. What's happening is the 2.0 organizations struggle to maintain their overhead or struggle to manage their liabilities. We're going to go from a world where cheap government financing and bonds papered over a lot of uneconomic behavior. And what's going to happen as more and more things get cut, for example, the Congress did not extend the emergency unemployment benefits at the end of 2013. As we see these kinds of cuts that really cut into the muscle of households in the economy, people are going to start asking questions. Well, if you can not afford to do this, why can you afford to do that? I use the example of why can Washington afford to pay a corporate contractor to do something for $150 an hour that can be teleported into my community and done for $25 to $50 an hour, and then you won't have to pay us food stamps and unemployment, and in fact, it'll be cheaper. So get ready for fundamental economics to start to matter, and more people are going to be interested in them. I walked through many of the different areas because one of the things I wanted you to see is that the collapse that we're watching in terms of the outstanding liabilities or the inability of 2.0 to pay them or cover their overhead, that's not about collapse. It's about implosion and collapse of those organizations and the many people who depended on them. It's not necessarily the collapse of the global economy, because 3.0 is clearly positioning itself to not just survive but thrive under these conditions. Money and markets. A lot to say, and I would encourage you to go through the web presentation. The U.S. equity markets were an enormous surprise. Not the strongest performance. As I said, the Japanese was, but the U.S. standard S&P 500 was up by almost 30% for the year. If anything, I expected a correction. We really didn't get one. We got what I would call a crash up. We saw, as I said, tremendous sort of gapping in valuations between the 2.0 and 3.0 model. I put a couple of examples up on the blog post between sort of what Business Insider defines as new media and old media. Very interesting, interesting chart. Although the developed world markets were up, Europe was up compared to the S&P. Europe was up about 18.9%. Although the developed world equity markets were not, the BRICS were down, the emerging markets down by about 6% for the year. And if you look at the gap between them, you know, as I said, the G7 called the capital home, and as it did, the BRICS fell. Commodities down. The Reuters Jefferies CRB index down about 5.1%. Many commodities down even more. I put a little chart up comparing Starbucks stock to coffee. Coffee down more than 30%. Starbucks stock up by 40%. Many of the falls in commodities, of course, lowered the cost of good for corporations, helping give support to corporate earnings, which explains some of the performance in the equity markets. Bonds were the spoiler. As I said, if you started the year in a long-term treasury bond fund, you ended the year down 10 to 15%. If anything, we've seen a turn in the bond market. We watched the Commodities Future Trade Commission struggle with their implementation of swap regulations as a result of the Dodd-Frank legislation in 2010. As the CFTC is successful, watch more transparency on that market. But as I said, we have never in the history of civilization lived through a period where we had rising interest rates with a huge book of interest rate derivatives. So if interest rates start to rise too fast, too quickly, you know, there could be fireworks. And what I've always said is I'm not concerned that we get a collapse in the global financial system. I'm concerned that we would get war. Rising interest rates made the world difficult for REITs this year. We saw a lot of the big REITs or hedge fund managers rolling up a lot of single family real estate, hoping to do IPOs. Many of them got delayed. The housing market was very much helped by the strong economy in the 3.0 areas, but also by the banks holding foreclosure portfolios out of the market. You'll almost wonder if that was part of the deal with the Fed. We'll buy your mortgage-backed securities if you keep the foreclosure properties off balance sheet. Currency was very interesting. The dollar continued strong, ending the year about where it started. It's very interesting. It rose up and then returned to the 80 level for the U.S. dollar index. The big currency story this year, of course, was Bitcoin. It made quite a splash, but it's under my category of something not to do. But as I said, this is all part of unfolding a global currency system. Bitcoin, I no more believe than the man in the moon that Bitcoin either now or ultimately will be anonymous. There was an effort underway to marry Bitcoin with gold, which from Mr. Global's standpoint would be the ideal currency if it happened. Precious metals, down a lot more than commodities. We see gold down significantly, silver down even more. It was a very painful year for precious metal investors who, if anything, expected the primary trend to reassert. In fact, it went the other way. I will do the Solari report by myself. I want to have a serious conversation about how we approach precious metals this year, and so it's easier to do it alone. Franklin will join us again in February. But I'll do that next year. I put a link in the web presentation to my article, What Percentage of My Assets Should I Hold in Precious Metals? And I would strongly recommend that you take a look at the web description in the wrap-up and take a look at that article and listen next week and more in precious metals then. Watch for private equity to be one of the most interesting areas in the market in 2014. I expect significant reinvestment of 3.0 pools of capitals in startups and early venture, particularly of new technology. The IPO market was very strong this year. If it's going to continue to be strong, watch for pension funds and institutional investors to be encouraged to shift capital in as well. This is all part of building the kind of companies and capacity you need if you're going to rebuild American manufacturing, if you're going to digitize the heartland, if you're going to do a private effort in space, if you're going to integrate new technology. All sorts of reasons that you're going to want to see an enormous amount of new and often cases relatively small companies start up and build. And this could be a very exciting area. The SEC is expected to issue final crowdfunding regulations in 2014. That's going to facilitate more equity investment. At the end of 2013, we saw them raise the minimums on Reg A to $50 million, which could, if it develops, could significantly speed up the private equity pipeline. The article was up on the blog. The PE ratios in the U.S. are currently high by historical standards. But it's interesting to note that they have often gone much higher. They've gone much higher during periods in which significant new technology has been introduced. So that's the Roaring Twenties and the tech bubble. Now, that can't happen without a significant increase in private equity activities to incubate and develop companies that grow into IPOs and expand the number of companies in the stock market. In fact, the number of companies in the U.S. stock market has shrunk tremendously over the last decade. And if we're going to have a strong economy, that growth needs to turn positive. I did a special report on crowdfunding and a Solari report, as well as had one of our attorneys publish or write for us a special report on the pathways for entrepreneurs to raise capital, both with and without crowdfunding. We plan to cover the new regulations when the SEC promulgates them in 2014. If a push develops to mandate 401ks for small business, which I think it might, let's hope communities create options for a portion to be reinvested in community venture. Ditto if the various proposals to privatize Social Security get dusted off and get serious, which I think is a much longer shot. If these accounts become eligible to invest in prudent vehicles to invest in small and local businesses that adopt 3.0 technologies, the economy could really shift into a new entrepreneurial phase, but let's not get our hopes up. Whatever happens, the end of the bull market in bonds and the shift of capital into 3.0 companies and technology is going to shift the global economy towards an equity model. And this is going to have an enormous impact on both the economy and the culture. You know, this is a deep shift in the, as I said, the water table of our entire society. I said at the beginning of this year that the housing markets would be strong where the economy was strong and where the weak where the economy was weak, and that's exactly what happened. In fact, in I think the Shiller reports that in the metropolitan areas, housing was up as much as 20% for the year. Again, where the 3.0 economy is strong, the housing markets were very, very strong. I also listed out a couple of predictions for the year under the market roundup. Expect the minimum wage to rise in numerous states and nationally. Expect discussion to get serious about moving back the retirement age under Social Security. Expect Model 2.0 governments to double down on coercion. Financial repression is upon us as the 2.0 governments struggle with how to manage their liabilities and maintain control. Don't be surprised to see many more activities that generate fees, fines, and asset seizures. It's a form of financing. It's the Sheriff of Nottingham model. Expect pressure on Congress to create a two-year solution at least to the debt limit crisis, so we won't have any more debt limit squabbles until after the next presidential election. If they don't, we're going to see downward pressures on financial markets if those squabbles occur. Finally, expect the pressure on your time to continue to increase as more and more governments and companies shift functions to a do-it-yourself model despite the increased complexity. Okay, that's Money and Markets. Selling Friendly Fascism 3.0. This is a very important one to understand. The NSA surveillance systems are 2.0. There is a much more dangerous face of fascism, and that's the 3.0 flavor. In Friendly Fascism 3.0, we voluntarily keep the intelligence agency's dossier on us up to date. We just call it social media. We pay for a surveillance and tracking device that we carry with us. We just call it a smartphone. We pay for the utility services that put a smart meter on our home that allows the utility and possibly other surveillance systems to track and record our daily activities and patterns. The critical thing to understand about Friendly Fascism 3.0 is that it is operated by private company and private investors. And they have computing and artificial intelligence resources that gives them the ability to harvest actionable intelligence from those information flows. Now, this invisible machinery is about to get an enormous infusion of invasive power with the introduction of drones on scale in U.S. airspace and robotics throughout the economy. Add this to recent developments in a multitude of areas, DNA, nanotechnology, brain research, computer power, transhumanism, and what you discover is friendly fascism is on the verge of moving completely and psychotically out of control. What is interesting is I have tremendous faith in a love of God and the fundamental intelligence and decency of the human race. And what's interesting is as our consciousness shifts, it has the ability to shift all of these tools and mechanisms. And I think it ultimately will. But in the meantime, please beware technology. The way fascism 3.0 is being adapted is the consumer is embracing this. The consumer loves social media. The consumer loves smartphones. The convenience that comes with all this stuff is amazing. But unfortunately, it's feeding the most intimate information about you and those you love to people who at the top of the food chain believe in slavery. I mean, that's what you need to understand. And it's funny, when I was living in Washington during a period many years ago when I was under 24/7 surveillance, I heard a sermon by a wonderful pastor who told the congregation that we should stop worrying about what other people think. Rather, we should realize that God and his angels hear and see everything we think and do. We needed to worry about that instead. And interestingly enough, that helped me come to a much more coherent and discerning relationship with invasive technology than the one I had the day before I heard that sermon. So I recommend that advice to you. But we're living in a world where we need to function to a very high standard, because everything we do or say can be known and can be made public. You know, I always tell everybody the enemy of the state was my training film to deal with that period of time. And you may want to go back and listen to that one, as well as another one we recommended on the Soleri Report to grapple with this phenomena called The Listening, Italian movie, wonderful film. The drumbeats of war, the most significant risk to the global economy, the thing that will bust up the slow burn, is not collapse. It's not a repeat of 2008, although that could happen. It's the risk of war. I mean, essentially, this time around, we're not going to have $27 trillion to do bailouts. And so there is a significant risk that someone or something goes to war. We've seen a lot of military action and enforcement action around the world over the last decade, and certainly over the last year. We saw the president try to go into Syria and fail. You finally got the feeling that we could say, you know, we finally got rid of the neocons. This game of pushing in, as we have to Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, kind of got stalled out at Syria and clearly was not going to make it to Iran. Part of the reason for these actions is, again, bringing in the train tracks of control. To do a digital currency system, you need everybody in the central banking model. You need everyone on the payment systems. You need everyone in the mechanism. You can't afford to have outliers like North Korea or Libya sort of bollocksing up the system, so you want everyone in. That's a reason why Russia and China, who don't want to see necessarily a global consolidation of power happen, provide support to these various entities. And of course, as we know, Eurasia, controlling Eurasia is absolutely essential to the control of the the oil and energy trade, and therefore the reserve currency. America has a very difficult challenge. If you run the reserve currency, you get the many benefits of being able to print money out of thin air to buy natural resources. At the same time, you have the expense of running the global enforcement operation, and it's a dance. To explore those challenges, we did a great Soleri report with Colonel Wilkerson, back for the second time on the Soleri report, to discuss the strategic challenges to the U.S. military. If you haven't listened to it, I recommend it. The defense budget is being reined in, and the pressure on the weapons manufacturers to make a case to support their budgets is on. and their need for foreign sales is on. And as we watch those announcements, you can't help but wonder if the squabbles in the East China Sea are related to the increasingly need for foreign sales for the infrastructure we've created. It's a little bit like the old joke about the snake and the snake oil potion from W.C. Fields. We see increasingly militaristic pronouncements by the Chinese and Japanese leadership. Again, is this real tensions, or is this a need for them to distract people from their domestic problems and to use warfare in the old perpetual maintaining centralized industries and controlled? Whatever's going on, the United States military is, in fact, engaged in a historic pivot to the east. It represents a significant change in strategy and global interests. The economic tiger and investment continues to move to the east, and America remaining the hegemon in Asia and East Asia is critical to maintenance of the reserve currency status. China launched their first aircraft carrier in 2013. They also announced plans to take their one-year-old satellite network in the Asia Pacific global, and they sent a lunar module to the moon. It's a long way from having a serious global military presence, but it's a beginning, and it reminds us of where all this could head. There's no one on the stage close to replacing the U.S. on the global stage. I can't tell you how much time I spent listening to people predict the momentary or the collapse of the U.S. dollar is something that was going to happen momentarily. It hasn't. But the reality is either the U.S. has got to reinvigorate its leadership, or if it continues in a permanent state of corruption, I said, blinded by the beauty of our weapons, we're going to see the Chinese and the BRICS continually chip away more than they've done. But the world's turning to an equity model one way or the other. And that's going to have an impact on the drumbeats of war. Hopefully someday, if we have enough investment equity in each or equity investment in each other, it will shrink the need for the big military budgets that we have. Next major development in 2013, the right of self-defense won. A federal effort to legislate gun control nationally failed. I believe that effort was a major promise to investors by the Obama administration. The Democrats had to make those commitments to get elected or to win the election. To not deliver on those promises would have been a severe blow to the administration politically. They didn't get it done, even after the April week from hell. And that is a huge and very important event. I don't begin to underestimate the power of the trench warfare that has now begun at the regulatory level and the state and local level to try and sort of implement the same result. At the same time, the events of 2013 say to me that the American people understand what is happening at some level, are not fooled by the mass shootings and the subsequent spin, and understand how important their maintaining their arms and the right of self-defense is to the negotiation of the outstanding liabilities of the 2.0 governments. The reality is with significantly less assets than liabilities, if someone has no clout or power, they're the ones who are going to get cut in the process of reengineering the federal budget. If the federal government can take away the guns, expect many more liabilities and retirement obligations to get abrogated much faster. It's interesting to note the statistics. In 2005, the U.S. government processed 9 million background checks for guns. In the first 11 months of 2013, they processed 19 million. Says to me, people are getting smarter. Wild cards and bad ideas. There are three important wild cards in the global economy going forward. Fukushima, I would say, is number one. We're getting continuing reports of risks and environmental impact of Fukushima on Japan, the oceans, and the global environment. They are of great concern. There is still much cleanup that needs to be done, and much can go wrong as that cleanup proceeds. I keep praying and keeping a watchful eye on that situation, but clearly it could have a very dramatic effect on not only the Japanese economy, but the global economy. Second one is weird weather. Drought and severe weather continues to be a significant problem in many areas. We note that sunspots are at a very low point, whatever that may mean. Now, all of this includes concerns that weather control and warfare may also be at work, but the greatest source of wealth around the planet is the harvest that the Earth gives us every year. Drought and severe weather can cut into that productivity enormously. Finally, I added UFOs. We see a deterioration in household incomes, pressing more and more people to ask what is happening and why. Where's the money? And that inevitably leads to questions about the black budget and where all this money's been disappearing to for many years. And that inevitably leads to questions about the UFO phenomena and why the breakaway civilization is behaving the way they're behaving. Richard Dolan, who's been on the Solari Report 2 years ago, is publishing a new book on UFOs in the first quarter of 2014. I've read a preliminary copy. It is the single best book I have ever seen to introduce this kind of serious conversation into the general population. Richard has agreed he will join us on the Solari Report as soon as this book is ready for publication. And I enjoy, I'm really going to enjoy having that conversation, because it's one that we need to have and crosses into many, many areas that are important to investment and to the allocation of our resources. Under the category of no, there are a number of very bad ideas being promoted. I'll just list them. You can read more about them on our web presentation. Crowdfunding a new constitution. That is not a hip, cool idea. Do not let the constitution get open to any kind of creative process, let alone one that could depend on social media, the internet, and entrainment technology. Wearable technology. What I said is, what is it about the Snowden revelations that you do not understand? Do you really want to walk around with a video camera on your head that feeds straight into the dark fiber tapped by the NSA and a group of private organizations and investors that are much worse than the NSA? Public banks, again, we don't want more government in the credit flows, particularly ones that can use a subsidized lower capital to put lots of private local banks and credit unions out of business. Rental bonds, very bad idea. If you thought you had fun in the subprime mortgage boom and bust, wait till you see rental bonds. And finally, bitcoins. I said, you know those crazy right-wing wackos that scream about the Bible and the mark of the beast? Get over their presentation and dig a little deeper to understand and appreciate the rights, the risks they are describing. We put links to several of our Bitcom commentaries and some of what I think are the most important articles. I think digital currencies are inevitable. If you want to try them, just make sure that you are prepared to lose 100% of what you put in full. And please assume that whatever you do is not anonymous. Make sure all the transactions are fully compliant with laws, regulations, and tax requirements. Unanswered questions is the next category. Who is really in charge? What are the risks and opportunities they are managing? What is driving the desire for society under tight control, central control with zero privacy? What is driving the development of underground bases, secret space programs, and invisible weaponry? Why are we promoting food systems, adopting vaccine and health policies, and implementing a global spraying program that looks suspiciously like depopulation? All intelligence is available to us if our alignment is in, is if our intent is in alignment with divine love. In this year, I would ask that we recommit to spiritual growth while our practical selves bring transparency to what I call the global weirdness of these questions. We're currently working on a series of events and ancillary reports throughout 2014 that will help us collaborate to try and bring transparency to these unanswered questions. And I really hope we make progress on it this year because the official reality that doesn't look at these questions is getting increasingly absurd and painful as it tries to describe what's going on in ways that absolutely make no sense. So the unanswered questions continue, and we hope to make progress on them this year. Our annual Celeri reports, our hero of the year is Alfredo Moser, the Brazilian mechanic and inventor who pioneered the leader of light, using plastic bottles inserted into rooftops to provide daytime light. Remarkable, remarkable invention that's spreading virally around the world. An amazing contribution. If anybody knows Moser's address, we're looking for it so that we can send a contribution and to say thank you. The movie of the year, believe it or not, is the 2010 remake of The A-Team. At the Celeri Report, we feel absolutely no obligation to choose a movie that was made in a given year. Rather, we're looking for the movie or documentary that is most appropriate to the times. The A-Team is a remarkable action comedy, and it's a story about a breakaway. It's about what you do when the system in which you are a part is so overtaken with corruption that you have to create your own world. You have to hold to higher standards of morality without regard to a former legal system of government, and you have to make your own way in a difficult world. Not surprisingly, finding the right people and teamwork is important. So it's also about finding your real family. As Andrew Vox once said, your family are the people who won't turn you in. So if you want to enjoy a great action comedy and explore the inner meaning of breakaway, you want to check out the 2010 remake of The A-Team. Okay, our New Year's resolutions. A couple suggestions for New Year's resolutions. You need a breakaway plan. Take a look at what and who is giving you energy and what and who is not, and see if there are appropriate shifts. Every person's situation is unique, so I don't know how to apply this to you in your lives, but again, it starts with heart and mind and then goes into all the practical considerations around you. Invest more time and effort in cost-effective ways to maintain optimal health. We had a couple of great Celeri reports, two with Laura Thompson this year, on detoxifying and how to build your immune system. We called it Winter Wellness. You can also check out one that we did with Laura in the archives on radiation poisoning if you're concerned about Fukushima. Definitely keep an eye out for new companies and services designed to help you do more with less. An example I gave on the web presentation is CrowdMed, which is a website that crowdfunds solutions to medical problems that are having that are challenged in arriving at a correct diagnosis and therapy. Not everybody's going to successfully adapt to the changes underway. Some are going to stay engrossed in anger or victim mentality or divide and conquer politics, or they're not going to be interested in developing higher learning speeds, or they're simply going to sit around waiting for financial collapse. As much as possible, you need to align with people who are interested in building a positive future connected to where you want to go, and are not going to sit around grumpy that the world turned out different than we wanted. So break away from people who are draining you, particularly people that in your mind you feel are not going to make it, and certainly not going to make it in the future in which you're headed. Your time is your most precious resource, and there's going to be a lot of pressure on your time whenever systems come down and new systems develop. There's always more pressure on everyone's time, and more things go wrong, more implosion, more learning to do. So do a time budget for 2014. Make sure You provide time to invest in your health, your skills, your family and friends, and colleagues who give you the most energy. Develop a plan on how to maintain mental freedom despite this kind of invasive technology. Some people find ways of, you know, turning everything off on the weekend and shutting it all out and, you know, putting their bare feet down on a tree and staying away from technology so that they can clear their minds and sort of build more coherency. If you want support, consider starting a Solaris Circle with people who can provide that support. We have several pieces in the archives on starting a Solaris Circle, but in 2013 we did one on starting one with the investment club aspect with Paul Ferguson. And finally, take heart to one of my favorite sayings from T.D. Jakes, God does not need what you have lost to bless you. Oftentimes, losses simply lighten the load. And if you look at where we're going, that's not always a bad thing. I certainly have had my loads lightened. And in many cases, it turned out to be a wonderful thing. And finally, I just want to tell you, I want to say thank you for a great year on the Solari Report. We are extremely excited about what's coming up. To handle the growth, we are in negotiations to move to new and much more professional subscriber software. You've been very patient in dealing with the subscriber software, much of it which we made ourselves. But now, as many new services pop up, we think we can provide you with a much more professional experience. We're also looking at moving the blog to a new host and being able to do many things which are much more mobile friendly. So prepare to see a lot more system support and features in the first half of the year. We're very much looking forward to that. And we have a great lineup. Dr. Farrell has agreed to come on and do a quarterly report. John Rappaport is going to stand down to every other or quarterly reports. We're going to get you on a quarterly cycle. Chuck Gibson's going to be doing our equity overviews. We have a great presentation on the bond market, which, as you can tell, is a major, is really the 800-pound gorilla, the bond market in interest rates for 2014. And then, of course, Franklin, interestingly enough, I asked Franklin to join us next month to talk about spiritual warfare and local economies and the prison ministry he's doing. He's doing some very interesting things. Coming up this month, we have, as I said, I'll be doing the Precious Metals Market Report on next Thursday. And I want to talk about how to proceed in a year where there are many different scenarios of what could happen. We could see the long-term bull reassert. It could take more than this year to reassert. I think all indications are, if anything, precious metals grows more important in the train tracks of the global financial system. But that doesn't necessarily mean prices are good. And there are scenarios where we could get prices moving up this year. But I think it's very important to have a framework for addressing that and managing that. And so I want to go through how to approach rocking and rolling in a year where many different things could happen and make sure you understand the variables that are going to be important. January 16th, a wonderful consultant, Ann Christensen, is going to join us from Santa Fe on Estate Planning 101. I've gotten many questions at the Solari Report about how to go about doing estate planning, and I think Ann is wonderful and help people organizing and going through the process in a way that really helps them achieve the results and make sure they're in control of their plan and how it gets implemented. January 23rd, John Rappaport will take that week, and then the final week of the month, Chuck Gibson and I will be doing the equity overview on the bond market and what it might mean to the equity markets in 2014. Can they continue to be strong, or will trouble in the fixed income and derivative markets instead make things more problematic? So until next week with Precious Metals Market Report, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to break away and start one. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck.